From VinePair's New York City headquarters, I'm Adam Teeter.
And I'm Joanna Sciarrino.
And in Seattle, Washington, I'm Zach Jabal.
And this is the Friday VinePair podcast. I'm actually not in the office today. I'm in Charleston, but whatever, you know.
Big living down there for
big
living. Why are you in Charleston, Adam?
For the Wine and Food Festival, which we've sponsored now for like the last 4 or 5 years. The original Wine and Food Festival in Charleston, the only festival that happens in Charleston that actually supports the community and is a nonprofit that gives back to chefs and supports scholarships and helps people from disadvantaged homes get into the restaurant and bar industry. Yeah, that Wine and Food Festival, not one that is starting that swaps the names to an F and a W. That's going to be in the fall. That's going to potentially hurt this festival that actually gives back to the community because some other people want to make some profits. So if you're a listener of the podcast and you control marketing dollars and you've been approached by this other festival, just know that if you support it, you actually will be hurting a festival that is beloved by the community, that is a nonprofit that gives back to the community and helps people enter the industry that we all love. All right, that's my plug. Anyways, that's why I'm down here.
Fair enough. Are you speaking, or are you just having fun?
Yeah, I'm giving a masterclass with Aaron Goldfarb on what is craft whiskey and craft whiskeys to look for. But it's going to be basically just a conversation that Aaron and I have about like what actually is craft, because a lot of the whiskeys we're actually pouring are owned by pretty large companies. But for whatever reason, amongst the taters, still have like a craft perception.
Yeah, sure. That makes sense.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about that. That should be fun. Keith's down there giving a class on wine regions to pay attention to. So he has two really great Psalms on his panel. They're going to be talking about, I think, wines from Virginia, wines from New York State, etc. And Tim is giving a gin class. So gins around the world. So that'll be interesting. Yeah, a lot of fun. And then obviously there's a lot of cool dinners that happen, lots of great, the grand tasting that happens for 3 days, but I'm flying back today actually on Friday. I'm not going to be down there for the whole weekend because I'm traveling way too much and I want to get home and hang out with Esty. So, and Naomi.
And Naomi.
So, yeah. So that's the deal. But yeah, I think the festival is always really great. They always do an incredible job, and the talent, first of all, I love the restaurant bar community in Charleston. I think it's incredibly vibrant and really awesome. And then they bring in really cool talent from around the country, but mostly from the South, obviously.
Yeah.
And it's been going for 20 years. So yeah. So again, think about it. What have you guys been reading on the site?
Zach, why don't you go first?
Sure. So I think that one of the pieces that I was most interested in is our friend Dave Infante's recent hop take about this sort of on again, off again, will they, won't they merger between Albertsons and Kroger. And I think, you know, a topic that's come up a bunch on this show, and we talked about it recently on an episode about wine, is the consolidation that's happening in both distribution channels. That's happened a lot over the last decade or so as some of the, you know, more and more alcohol wholesale is happening through one or two big companies in most states, if not all states. And similarly, you're having all this grocery consolidation, and grocery retail is a huge channel for, in particular, beer and wine, spirits in some states, not all. And it's just really interesting the way in which this, so many parts of the beverage alcohol industry stand to suffer in the face of this kind of consolidation, because these really big buying entities can set really very hard to meet price points for most product. They also just sort of reduce the amount of product that's on store shelves because they're looking at scalability. They're looking to buy regionally, if not nationally. So yeah, I thought it was a good overview of that. I certainly hope that the FTC, as it seems to be, is, you know, taking an active stance against this, and this merger does not go through. But Dave does a really good job of laying out a lot of what's at stake here.
Yeah.
Joanna, how about you?
Yeah, I a lot of good stuff on the site this week. I want to call out an excerpt that we published from Aaron Goldfarb's newly released book, Dusty Booze, about, vintage tequila and collectors and, you know, some of the the people involved in tequila back in the 90s, who made some really amazing expressions that people seek out today. I also want to talk about Maggie Hennessy's piece about, you know, the enduring fanaticism around a properly poured Guinness.
Always.
Yeah. And I thought that piece was really great, kind of this idea of the two-part pour and, you know, if it's even necessary anymore. But, you know, people really cling to that. And it's such a part of the brand and the drinking experience when it comes to Guinness. So I really like that piece as well. What about you, Adam?
I actually had a two-part poured Guinness last night.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I feel like that, yeah, that's everyone thinks that you have to pour it in two parts. Otherwise, it's not correct.
Yeah. Because before, so, you know, obviously we don't record this on the Friday. So the night before I flew down to Charleston, I was at the Diageo offices at their bar.
Oh.
And I was like, well, if there's anywhere to order a Guinness and have it poured the correct way, it would be here.
Yeah.
And it was absolutely delicious. That beer, when it's served, I don't know what, yeah, I think it is the romance, et cetera, but like when it comes draft and the person pours it the correct way, there's almost no better beer on draft.
No, we've talked about it. It's damn near perfect.
Mm-hmm. Damn near perfect. So I thought the piece that so obviously I loved Aaron's excerpt.
Yeah.
And the other piece that I loved this week was related, which was by Susanna Skiver Barton. And it was about tequila having conquered the United States, but her question is like, can it actually win over the world? And there's a larger conversation I want to have on this podcast. I think maybe we should do it for a week or two from now, just about COVID comps and sort of how that's completely fucked the entire alcohol beverage industry. There's a lot of data that's being released and stuff that I've been looking at recently just about how it's affecting sort of, especially companies that are public, like their perception on the street, et cetera, based on just what happened during COVID. So that's a fun conversation to come in a week or two. So get ready for that. But one of the things that is completely out of whack is the comps on tequila, because it just exploded during COVID. And now the only way that it's really being considered to keep up with that massive demand, that massive growth, because now you know, these big companies need to show Wall Street they're still growing, is this sort of idea that potentially it can blow up in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Susanna gives a lot of reasons for why that's going to be very challenging. And what the perception of tequila still is there, you know, we're still really in the age where in Europe, the overwhelming tequila that's consumed are mixto tequilas. So those are tequilas that are not 100% agave. Those are the tequilas that like sort of 20 or 30 years ago in America, we thought of as what tequila was. And that was literally the kind of liquid that you drank and threw up in a toilet a few hours later.
Like shooting tequila, like shots.
Exactly.
Shot culture, right?
Shooting tequila and bad hangover tequila, right? And it's taken decades for the awareness of 100% agave. So this is how I'm connecting it to Aaron.
Yeah.
It's taken decades for people to be aware of it. I mean, Aaron sort of talks about in his piece, his excerpt from his book, Dusty Booze, that, you know, we really started talking about 100% agave tequila in sort of agave, you know, geek circles in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And then really kind of took off in the 90s. So like if you're thinking now, wow, that was basically 30, maybe 40 years ago. And then we saw the boom in you know, 2020, 2021. Like the idea that this explosion is going to happen in Europe overnight, I think is pretty, you know, it's pie in the sky.
Yeah.
I just don't think it's going to happen that quickly. And she's talking about how like it's really, I think that the figure she is like only about 2%. Of all tequila sales are still coming from this region of the world. It's going to take a very long time, but a lot of large companies are like staking a lot of their earnings against the hope that tequila is going to boom in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's just like a really important piece that needs to keep happening, because, you know, we want to report on what these big CEOs are telling Wall Street about what their goals are in order to keep their earnings up, to keep their market cap high. And, you know, looking into whether or not these strategies are realistic, I think is very important. I think Susanna does a very good job of questioning that. So anyways, the conversation I want to have today is one that came to me recently based on some conversations I was having with bartenders. And that's this idea of whether or not a bartender who creates a drink that becomes what we might call a modern classic should have first not only credit but financial stake in that drink in perpetuity, right? And so what do I mean by that? So credit, for example, is just, you know, should other bars who make that drink let their patrons know that this was a drink created by X person. So the perfect example I would have for that is like the Cosmo, right? Should people, you know, tip their hat to Toby Caccini and say he's the creator of the Cosmo, blah, 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 blah. Obviously, Cointreau has decided to go all in on that. You know, they're featuring him in commercials now with Aubrey Plaza, talking about how he's the inventor of the drink, etc. But also, should, if that drink were ever to be bottled by a RTD company, there's lots of people making RTD Cosmos, should they not only credit Toby on the bottle, but should he get some kind of payout? And again, I don't have a real strong opinion here. I wanted to sort of, I think it's a fun conversation. I would also like to hear what the listeners think, but there's a lot of these drinks out there that are well known. You have the Oaxacan Old Fashioned, created by Phil Ward. You have the Naked and Famous, created by Joaquin Simo. You have obviously the Cosmo by Toby. You know, so many of these drinks that have been talked about on Cocktail College that were created by really famous bartenders. You have, sorry, like the Penicillin and the Paper Plane, both created by
Sam Roth.
Sam Roth. Like, I was like, why did I forget his name all of a sudden? He's like, he's the only one that actually is pretty well known for being a little bit litigious when it comes to defending the fact that he's created these drinks. But you have these really well-known drinks that have, you know, made it into pop culture, not just the Cosmo. I think there's an episode of Younger. Anyone else watch Younger? I only watched it in the background. Naomi was a big fan.
No.
Joanna, did you watch Younger?
No.
Oh.
I don't know what it is. Sorry.
It was also created by Darren Star, but about like a – now this is way too much details, but like about a woman who gets divorced and she's like in her late 40s or something. She has kids who are teenagers and decides to like – get a job back in publishing, but in order to get the job, she pretends she's in her 20s.
Ah, okay.
Because she still looks like she's in her 20s. It's a famous actress. I forget her name.
Anyway,
you guys
Foster.
Remind me.
Sutton Foster.
Yeah, Sutton Foster, yeah. Right? And there's like a scene where they're at a cool party on the roof somewhere, and they're ordering rounds of Naked and Famous. Like, oh, well, yeah, that's the coolest drink. So like these drinks show up in pop culture, right? Like everyone talks about them, the Jungle Bird, et cetera. Like who has revived them? Who has created them? And so the question is, if you're the one who created it, like should you see something? Should you see a piece of other people then taking that drink and capitalizing on it, putting it into a bottle, you know, selling it? I mean, that's basically the only way that I think a lot of these bigger RTD companies, you know, are continuing to stay relevant is by bottling some of these drinks, because these are the drinks that are much less likely for you to make at home. So that makes sense for me for them to bottle them. So anyways, I'm curious what you guys think, because it was a fun conversation I was having with a few bartenders at our after hours party, actually. And I would love to hear your thoughts.
So I think there's sort of like two pieces to this, and you posed this too. I think the question of attribution and credit and sort of like recognition for a drink's creation is, I think, by and large handled relatively well within the industry. Although I do think that, you know, when you have a drink, like I think the Cosmo is almost on a different level than something like the, you know, like the other drinks you cited, even the Paper Plane, the Naked and Famous, where it achieved such escape velocity and so long ago that Cosmos are everywhere, and not every place that makes one or lists one is going to credit Toby. And I think at some point you're just kind of like, well, you know, it's like trying to, you know, put the horse has left the barn on this one. I think for newer creations, you know, I think that's, again, something where it's a little bit up to the creator or the bar that creates it of to what extent do they want to really stand on principle there and make a point. And you know, as you mentioned, certain bartenders have been more aggressive about making sure they get the proper credit. But I think that there's a fundamental thing to keep track of in this conversation, which is that, like, from a legal standpoint, you basically don't have any right to copy. There's no such thing as copywriting or trademarking a cocktail. Like, you just cannot do it. Recipes are not something that can be trademarked. That's just how copyright law, at least and trademark law, at least in this country, work. And I think it's pretty similar in most other countries where, for a variety of reasons, and I actually think for cocktails, it makes a lot of sense, because you're not really, what you're doing is blending already you know, kind of readily available ingredients together, you're not making something from scratch. So if you create your own spirit, you can, you know, patent that recipe, right? If you create your own version of, you know, your own Amaro or something like that, well, that recipe itself can be trademarked if you care to, or the name of it, certainly the brand of it. But if you take a bunch of widely available ingredients and mix them together, you can't call that out, that result, a thing that you yourself own. And if you think about it through the lens of other ways that this could be applied, it makes a lot of sense, right? Like if I take Coca-Cola and Pepsi and blend them together, I can't call it Zach's Cola and say that it's my proprietary product. You know, that's just not how things work. I haven't created anything on my own. I've just blended sort of, you know, over the, you know, readily available ingredients together. I can do that. I can sell it, I suppose, if I want, if I don't get Coke and Pepsi after me, which I'm sure I surely would if I was trying to do that. But the point is, like, that's not a, you haven't created something, you know, in a way, in the eyes of the law. And so I think that, you know, yes, it would be great if some of these companies making money off these drinks would, you know, give something to the creator. But I also think, and here's maybe where I'm going to get the blowback, I think that we have to be careful about the idea of what does it mean to create a cocktail? Because I think that a lot of the ones that are cited are functionally, you know, we talked about this on an episode a while back, are riffs. And what is a riff? Well, a riff is taking an existing template and changing usually one or maybe two things. And yes, maybe you were the first person to do it, or maybe you were just the first person to do it and then talk loudly to everyone you know about how you did it, which is undeniably the case with some of these drinks. I don't think that means that you're entitled to some sort of financial compensation beyond whatever you get from selling it yourself.
Right.
Yeah.
My one question before Joanna jumps in with her thoughts, though, with that is, okay, I understand that these are mostly riffs. And in the restaurant world, I get that like a chef might be inspired by another chef and riff on one of their pasta dishes, or, you know, like ever since the Nomad restaurant RIP, you know, started stuffing a roast chicken with truffles, other people started doing it too, right? But no one called it the Nomad roast chicken.
Right.
They called it something else. So that's fine that it's a riff, but then should you, if you're going to make a cocktail that's like that, should you use the name? I get that that's also a way that you're, you know, tipping your hat to and acknowledging that it is already a cocktail that someone else made first, but then it is their cocktail, right? I don't know. Joanna?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I think that saying it's a riff on something is a good way to kind of acknowledge that it came from somewhere else, but this is your spin on it, and that you have the, you know, some amount of creativity to turn it into something your own. I think with food recipes in particular, I guess all of this is just like, it's all very hard to enforce, right? So I think, and also I just think cocktail culture has fundamentally evolved from back when a number of the drinks that you mentioned, Adam, were created. Right. And we've heard from a number of different cocktail college episodes that, you know, back in the day before social media and before like the internet and stuff, that people had to, bartenders had to learn about drinks by actually going to other bars in different places in the country and having them and being inspired by them and then wanting to recreate them in their own bars. And that's kind of how cocktail recipes proliferated back then. Now it's so, so different, right? Because you see something on Instagram and you can very easily, you know, a bar in Alaska, they're doing something that you want to do in Philadelphia and whatever, you could do that very easily. You don't have to acknowledge anyone now. But I think back in the day, there was a certain amount of acknowledgement that had to happen because of word of mouth, right? So I think that's definitely part of it. But as far as the financial part of it, I do think that it is a shame when you have a big brand making and bottling something like a Naked and Famous. Yeah, maybe the creator of that drink should earn something from that if it's like a big company doing this. I think if it's like a small bar bottling cocktails and, you know, the earning potential there is relatively slim, fine. But like you have a big alcohol company bottling a Cosmo, maybe the creator of that drink should earn something from that.
Well, maybe you should also, if at least try to reach out to them and see if they want to be involved in the creation of it the formulation of the recipe, you know, how it's going to be bottled. I agree. I think it's very difficult.
Yeah, it's like all difficult.
The bar thing, I agree with you. I think we're kind of all on the same page about the bar thing, which is like, I think it's a nice thing. I think it's nice if they credit them if that's available. But like, the way that more people learn about just great cocktails is that they make the great cocktails made by sort of the modern day great cocktail creators. And I don't have a big issue with that, because also like a lot of these cocktails get written about and then, you know, the bar may not even want to put that cocktail on their menu or intend to, but then consumers come in asking for paper planes.
Yeah.
Because they've read about them in publications like ours, or you have brands that now have whole ad campaigns around the paper plane, Nonino, because it's their drink, basically. And people start asking for it at random bars, teaching bartenders how to make it, and then they'll be making it. But now if a company that's not Nonino makes a quote unquote paper plane and bottles it, I do think Sam should get some credit, as should Nonino. And if they're going to actually make that drink, it better have Nonino in it, right? If it doesn't, then like it actually technically isn't that drink. And maybe don't call it that. Maybe call it the cardboard plane. I don't know.
But what about like a Negroni then?
I think, yeah, I have a lot of issues with the Negroni. Like I'm very much on team Tim that
it's a Campari
cocktail. Negroni is a Campari cocktail.
Yeah.
It's not a bitter
red liqueur gin or whatever.
It's a Campari cocktail. Yeah. Anything else is a Negroni-inspired drink, but it's not a Negroni. And again, I've now tasted a lot of the fast followers that are trying to mimic Campari and do it with – and I think also, by the way, I think it's very dubious, and we get into a very shady area when we start saying – that the Campari you're making is done with more natural ingredients instead of the Campari, like whatever.
No,
don't do that. But also none of them are as good as Campari.
Yeah.
In that drink, whatever Campari's formulation is what makes a Negroni taste like a Negroni. And you know, you want to make a different kind of drink. You're like, this is a 3-part bitter cocktail that's inspired by a Negroni, but made with Chinar. Fine. Mm-hmm. But it's not a Negroni. And I think, look, that's the same argument you have from Gosling's about the Dark and Stormy. Yeah. Like the Dark and Stormy is their cocktail.
Trademarked. Yep.
And it better have Gosling's rum in it and their ginger beer. Or it's not Dark and Stormy. And I kind of agree with that. Like, look, there are loose cocktails that I think you can do whatever you want with, right? The martini, the Manhattan, the margarita, like these cocktails from ages and ages and ages ago that everyone has riffed on and interpreted, etc., where like you want to bottle that and make your version of it, go for it. Honestly, you'd be smart to do 1,000 riffs on those drinks because they're the most popular drinks in America, right? So do you know, out of in our cocktail library, 3 of the top 10 cocktails in our library every year are margarita riffs.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's also just something that's very important for the drinks community and the bartending community and the people who are aware of these things. But when you think of average consumers, like they have no clue who created these drinks at all. And that's why I think a big part of this is a big responsibility falls to like cocktail historians and people like Robert Simonson, who publishes books that actually with these recipes that actually credit the people who claim to have created them. And I think that's another component of this too. And Zach, you kind of alluded to it earlier, but like, sure, we acknowledge certain people as the creators of these drinks, but I'm sure there are hundreds of other people who might claim that they made them as well.
Yeah. I think, you know, two last things I want to make a point on here. One is that I do think that, you know, I was listening to the live version of Cocktail College recently, actually re-listening to it because I wanted to kind of get a sense for a couple of things that were talked about in preparation for this conversation, because something just jumped out at me there, which is that even when we compare like the conversation that was had on that episode about the drink that was created for Sunken Harbor Club, the Brain Fog that they tasted third in the episode. Great episode, by the way. Go listen to it if you haven't already. The conversation about the drink creation process and the months of of trial and error that went into it. You know, the modern cocktail creation process, especially at places like that, at some of the other really high-end cocktail bars, is an order of magnitude, if not more, beyond what even was done for these drinks that we're talking about, the Cosmo, the Naked and Famous. Those were much more like, hey, okay, we're in true riffs, right? We're going to take this established cocktail template and I'm going to change one or two ingredients. Maybe I'm slightly changing the proportions, but you know, we have gotten to a point now with cocktail creation that is like so precise. It is so much more a technical and almost scientific achievement. And that's not meant to say that it's better or worse than. It's just different. And those are such, like, you could never recreate the brain fog, I don't think, without knowing exactly what went into it. And partially, Sunken Harbor Club is intentionally, and Tiki has kind of always been this way, like, they don't tell you what all the ingredients are and the proportions. And that's, like, part of their deal. If you want that drink, you better fucking go to their bar. And again, different time. Maybe some of these bartenders who created these cocktails 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago wish they had been a little bit more secretive about it. Maybe they would have been able to exert more control about where the drink went and how they got credit or compensation or both for it. But the truth is that I think that we do need to sort of draw some distinction between, I changed an ingredient out versus like a wholesale kind of, there's always going to be a template. I mean, there's only so many ways you can combine these ingredients that taste good, but the amount of technique and the amount of fine tuning and the amount of precision that goes into a drink now, a new cocktail creation in 2024, it's unrecognizable to me from what I was doing 10 or 15 years ago. And even the best bartenders were doing. And that's really cool, I think, in a lot of ways, but it also means that like the downside to it is like those drinks are not transferable, and maybe that's good for the creators in certain ways, but it does also mean that like, I don't think drinks spread at the same rate that they do. Even if they're more accessible from a social media standpoint. Again, whether it's a very kind of expensive equipment or laborious technique or just precise recipes that no one is going to share, I actually think we're like past that age in a lot of ways.
Yeah, when we were having this conversation recently with the editorial team, I would be, you know, hard-pressed to find bartenders who exist today who actually want to, like, take somebody else's recipe anyway, right? Like, isn't a big part of being a bartender today doing exactly what you just talked about, Zach? Like, spending a lot of time researching and developing your own recipes to be something really special that you can only have at that bar. And, I mean, that's what I would assume. I'm sure it, of course, still happens and people are still inspired by the drinks that they have at other people's bars. But yeah, it just feels like people would rather come up with their own stuff than necessarily riff on somebody else's thing at this point.
You know, Joanna, that makes complete sense. I think that's a really great point. You know, I think the only people that are really trying to that I think we could think about whether or not this really is applicable is sort of what we've all been saying, which is this sort of RTD world. And I was thinking about this a little bit more as you guys were talking. Like, this really feels to me like maybe we should think about this in the way that we think about music. And, you know, obviously if you're performing someone's song as a cover live, that's usually okay, right? But if you record someone's cover or you use someone's song in a TV show, etc., like, you have to pay a royalty. And that's kind of where I think we're all landing here, right? Is like, if you choose to riff on someone's cocktail or even fully replicate that at your bar, that should be okay because you're kind of helping to promote the work, if that makes sense, right? And eventually someone's going to want to maybe try to taste the original, especially if that bartender still is alive and making that cocktail somewhere. Maybe they don't want to make that cocktail anymore, or they want to be cheeky about it, like Mr. Caccini does with his Cosmos. But I think if you bottle it and you put that name on it, you know, maybe we should apply those same rules. I think that would be only fair. But let us know what you think. Hit us up at podcast@vinepair.com. Tell us what you think about this entire conversation. Do you feel like bartenders who create cocktails should receive more credit than they currently do? Is it fair to offer them royalties? Should that be something that we start talking about in this industry, especially as we're seeing more and more RTDs come out with these cocktails in their vessels? And Joanna and Zach, I'll talk to you Monday.
Have a nice weekend.
Sounds great.
Thanks so much for listening to the Vine Pair Podcast, the flagship podcast of the Vine Pair Podcast Network. If you love listening to this show, or even if you don't, but I really hope that you do, as much as we really do love making it, then please drop us a review or a rating wherever it is that you get your podcast, whether that be iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, anywhere. If you are listening to this on a device right now, through an app, however you got this audio, please drop a review. It really helps everyone else discover the show. And now for some totally awesome credits. So, the Vine Pair Podcast is recorded in our New York City headquarters and in Seattle, Washington, in Zach Jabal's basement. It is recorded by Zach, mastered and produced by Zach. He loves all the credit. Keep giving it to him. Drop his name in the reviews. He's going to love hearing how much you love him. It is also recorded in New York City by our tastings director, Keith Beavers, who is the managing director of the entire Vine Pair Podcast Network. I'd also love to give a shout out to our editor-in-chief, Joanna Sherino, who joins us on every single podcast as our third and most important host. Thank you as well to the entire Vine Pair staff and everyone who's been involved in making Vine Pair as special as it's become. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week.